Time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
Sponsored by Serta Pro Painters.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Good morning, Mr. Hancock. How are you?
Top of the morning. All is well. I'm in a good mood. I'm feeling good today. Which, you know, when you get to be my age, you don't feel good every day.
You know these people in life that, like, you mention their name and everybody just says, what a great person. Do you have friends like that?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, he's just one of those people that, I've got a brother-in-law. His name is Paul Boschert.
I know him.
And Paul's one of those people. I don't care where you say his name, who you say it to. Everybody would say,
great guy.
What a great guy.
I would say that he is, in fact, a great guy.
We have another friend from St. Charles, that Terry Hollander, I'd put
great
in that same
guy.
Category. So Paul's one of those guys. Well, one of the good guys won yesterday.
Mm.
My brother-in-law, Paul, became the president of Duchesne High School, which is his alma mater, all my family. There we were all lined up at school yesterday to watch Paul get sworn in to run our school.
What a great
one of the good guys won.
Yeah.
And it was really cool. And I got a little tour of my old school, stomping grounds.
Yeah.
You know, it's well documented here. I hate school.
Yeah.
Dude, they had a room. It was as big as our entire office that was nothing but e-sports gaming. Do you know what this is?
E-sports.
It's like televisions with, you know, video games.
Oh.
And there's competing schools against schools.
Full of joysticks in there.
Yeah, and then I go into it, PlayStations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When I tell you, John, that there were five TVs, there were 20. It was unbelievable. And cool chairs to sit in. Then I go into this, they got a radio studio.
Yeah.
Inside. They can tape just as nice as what you and I are sitting here.
Wow.
A television studio.
Wow.
Where they can record, you know, news to go out to the school. Then I went to this other area and they've got this STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering.
Buddy, I'm well acquainted with STEM.
And they're building stuff out. I'm thinking, if school would have been beanbags and video games back when I was in school, I'd have a whole different outlook. Than what's happening now.
It got you excited, did it?
Yeah, it was super cool. And
see, yeah. I didn't need all those bells and whistles back in the day. Michael Frostfield Elementary School,
right.
1969, walking in the door there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was the smell of the books. Boy, you walk into the library, Michael, and you open up the old card catalog. You start rifling through the cards. They're finding your book using the Dewey Decimal System. That was it for me.
Yeah.
I knew I was home when I was, and I loved school. And it's important if you got kids out there, and we know that many of our listeners have very young great-grandchildren. you know, it's important for the young people that they enjoy the whole school experience from day one, walking in the door, so
that
they embrace the joy of learning.
Hey, since you brought up the Dewey Decimal, when was the last time you went to a library?
Oh, I've just been, you know.
Well, you went to vote there the other day.
I did.
But
I mean, yes.
In terms of actually getting the book, I would assume the Dewey Decimal system that we use. But
it's all computer.
It's no longer card cataloged.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's
But they still sort it by the numbers of the Dewey Decimal.
Well, you got to find the book.
Yeah, with computers these days.
And you got to still find the book.
Yeah, but my phone knows where I'm at, you know, in Forest Park. I bet that we could find out where a particular book is in a library.
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
But you got to get to the, and then it's got to be shelved right. Think about these poor librarians.
Upside down.
Got all these books they got to put back on the shelves. And just in the right, there's a particular place for every book. Isn't that special?
Right.
Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
There's no book out of place. And you got to get the .125 next to the point. To whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
So you still remember how to do it?
Oh, buddy, I love the library.
It would take me a little bit to figure out the Dewey Decimal walking in one more time. But I got to go fiction or nonfiction. Okay, now what am I looking in the science category or blah, blah, blah? And what number does that associate with? I need a little refresher.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's all available to you out there, Michael. You just walk into school. You go to your brother-in-law. He'll tell you all about it.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Paul Boschert.
Yeah,
welcome back to the Hancock and Kelly Show. We're going to stay with you all the way till 11 o'clock. We'll join Amy, she's not here today. She's
Amy
on vacation.
Go.
We'll visit with Chris Ranji and Mike Elam. You can also see Hancock and Kelly, the television show. That's on Sunday mornings at 8:30. We're going to have two segments of politics coming at you right now. So let's get started on number one, John.
Let's get after it.
This Tuesday night was the much-anticipated debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. They both faced off there in Philadelphia. It was the first debate since the replacement of Joe Biden as the candidate. A lot of the eyeballs were focused on Kamala Harris. Would she be able to answer the bell? I don't think any of us anticipated what happened. From my perspective, she was an outright thrashing of Donald Trump. Who'd you think won the debate, and any other thoughts on how it all went down?
Well, Donald Trump lost the debate, and you know, it should have been a fairly simple, straightforward. This election is a change cycle election. Why is it a change cycle? Because if you look at any poll, the percentage of the public that believes the country is on the wrong track is in the 70s. It fluctuates 72%, 78%. And when you've got that particular dynamic in the electorate, it should accrue to the benefit of the party that's challenging the occupant of the White House. So with that as a backdrop, and I think one of the reasons that Trump, you know, despite some stumbles along the way, is still right there in all of the polling data is because of that wrong track number. So you go into a debate, and the objectives that he did not achieve are why he lost that debate. You can talk about the rambling and the eating the dog stuff, and all of that didn't help. But fundamentally, what he didn't do is pin the state of the economy on the Biden-Harris administration. He didn't talk to them. He mentioned it in passing in his first answer about the expensiveness. You can't buy bacon. You can't buy, you know, whatever he said. But what he should have been able to do is articulate that administration created a situation where the cost of living for average Americans has gone through the roof and people are suffering, and then get into her policy prescriptions where she's going to hand out $25,000 for a first-time home buyer and give all of these tax breaks and pump more money into the economy, which is inherently inflationary. Had he done that, it would have been a much better night, but he did none of that. And so he clearly lost the debate. She, for her part, looked presidential. That was a hurdle for her.
Right.
She didn't have the word salad problem that she's had in interviews over the course of her career. And so, I mean, she acquitted herself well. Your thoughts?
She was strategically flawless. I mean, they had a plan coming into this election. I think back to 2016, most people were introduced to Donald Trump, of course, by The Apprentice, but mainly by those Republican debates where he was such an outlier, such a disruptor that nobody knew how to deal with him. Then 2020 comes around, same situation. They were still trying to learn how to deal with it. We now know there's a plan on how to deal with Donald Trump. It's to force Donald Trump to talk about Donald Trump. If you think about the first answer Kamala Harris had the other night, it was the question about, are you better off than you are 4 years ago? She never answered it.
Right.
She had a hard time with that question. Probably would have. And by the way, the second piece that you pointed out, Donald Trump's answer was about bacon and cereal, how laughable that is coming from him, but accurate for him to point out. And that really was the low light for her. Then she started to execute her own strategy. And John, it was like fighting your little brother. I mean, she knew exactly what was going to happen. Heck, anybody who was watching that knew what was going to happen. The second she started to talk about his crowd sizes, we all knew that it was going to go back to him and we were about to watch a meltdown.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that was the moment that the debate turned. I think it was like 28 minutes in. She starts telling her people, you know, you really ought to go to one of these rallies. Yeah. They're boring and people are leaving early and blah, blah, blah. Well, that was absolutely by design, and it was absolutely brilliant. The question coming back to Trump on immigration from the moderator was, you encouraged Republicans to kill the bipartisan immigration bill. Why did you do that? And Trump's response was, first, I want to talk about, you know, my crowds.
Right.
And then he goes into this thing about crowds. That produced then, when he did get to the immigration question, he didn't address the question that was asked, but that's typical in a debate. But that's where the whole eating dog and cat thing came out. It was in that immediate exchange coming out of Kamala Harris going after Trump's crowd sizes. What he should have said on the immigration bill, and I don't know, you know, there's been a lot of people denigrating the coaching that he received. And that may well be true, but it also may be true that I'm inclined to believe that Donald Trump's not particularly coachable.
Right.
You know, and you have that in sports. Baseball players, they just won't take creative, you know, quality instruction. Anyway, what he should have done with that immigration bill question was saying, look, you're going to get one shot at this policy. And that particular bill was weak. Now, you know, and his supporters are going to believe that was a weak bill.
Mm-hmm.
And why we don't vote for a weak bill is because when I'm in office, we're going to have a strong bill and we're going to close the border. We're going to da-da-da-da-da. Done. Well, period. The end.
Make the argument that you only have one shot to get it right.
Yep.
If we truly have come some type of bipartisan thing, we only have one shot to get it wrong. I think it's a false argument, but I can understand how you can spin that.
Of course it is. And, but it's an argument. It's responsive, and it would have worked.
So here's the ultimate disruptor, right? And we all know what the word disruptor means. We're living with it, right? Whether it be our phones, our cars, everything is a disruptor in this market. Well, Donald Trump was the ultimate disruptor. Doesn't he need to continue to have disruptions going forward? Is this smart to come out and say, no, I'm not debating anymore?
Well, you have to believe, despite his rhetoric that he won the debate and that 92% of the people agree that he won the debate, you have to believe that he knows he didn't perform well. It doesn't take him. You don't have to be particularly insightful to know that that debate did not go well for him. So I think what he's essentially saying without saying it is that, you know, if another one like that and we're toast. So I think he's looking at it from that standpoint. And I do think he genuinely believes that the moderators are not going to give him a fair shake. And I don't think the ABC moderators acquitted themselves particularly well at all in that debate. But if you're losing, and if you're down in the polls, and if he's got down 2, 3, 4 points in, you know, 4, 5, or 6 of the battleground states, he's going to need another, he's going to need something external to change the direction that the race is going in right now.
So I appreciate that that's what Republicans or losers of the debate going to say, it was rigged against me, it's biased, etc. But I think everybody saw it. It was a thrashing. And what it did to me as a partisan, now I'm a leftist who's going to vote for any functioning adult over Donald Trump. But what it did for me is it was reminiscent of January 6th. For him to sit there and say, what you saw with your own eyes didn't happen. I won with 90% of the vote.
Right.
I wonder if that tickled anybody else's brain that way as it did to me, because it just brought me back to where it was. Hey, John, all this is happening. The Republicans in Washington, D.C. are trying to maybe potentially have some type of a government shutdown. They would like to drive this to cause some troubles. And I think it's being pushed by the far right wing of the Republican Party. But government shutdowns have never worked out for the party that shuts it down, and in particular, it's never worked out for the Republicans.
Yeah, it's not a good political maneuver. So what happens is October 1 begins the new fiscal year, and so they're going to have some kind of a spending plan in place, and probably, given the state of things, they're going to need a new debt ceiling limit enacted. And there's a lot of people who are talking about, in Washington, trying to, there's this voting act that a lot of the GOP are pushing that would prohibit folks that are not citizens from voting in our elections. Okay? And the Democrats say, well, that's already the law, and all of the states' elections are a function of state governments or whatever. And why are you conflating that issue with keeping the government open? So that's where the debate is right now. The Republicans are going to try and, you know, get a win out of this thing some way, and they've chosen this illegal voting matter. I think they could probably get something better than that, but regardless, that's where it is. The smart politics, if it prevails, would say, just get a deal done, keep the government going, and let's
have the fight.
Let's have the fight and win the election.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Now we look at Missouri. Two major things happened this week. We found out that one, abortion would be on the ballot. And two, gaming, digital gaming, sports betting sports was going to face a funded opposition.
Yes.
I look at these, I think abortion finds itself in a solid spot.
Well, they're sitting on $9 million bucks right now that's been raised from all over the country. There's much less than that on the other side.
So it's probably in a favorable position. Gaming, sports gaming, which I think the majority of Missourians would like, probably faces a little bit more of an uphill battle because of a funded opposition.
Yeah, and this is the same kind of a repeat of what happened in California on this issue in one of the casino companies there. But there's so much to talk about. Colonel McCausland joins us next hour, and we'll be back after the news right here on KMOX.
Hey now, happy happy Monday, happy Friday.
Well, it's Monday somewhere.
Yeah, buddy, no, I don't want to wish away our whole weekend. You know, like we did. Tomorrow's like my day to sleep in.
I'm excited for the weekend.
Are you? Why is that?
Well, I've got stuff and things going on.
Stuff and things.
Yes,
it's impressive.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to tell you a story. And what was that old TV show? The facts are the truth, but names and likeness have been changed to protect the whatever.
The innocent.
Yeah, the innocent. All right. So I'm going to tell you a story. I've got a couple of different experiences that happened to me just this week.
Just this week?
With people that I know to be good human beings.
Fine.
Put aside
Americans.
Their politics. I know them from my Catholic faith, etc. One lady that I have a relationship with, know her, it's not a relative, it's not a, you know, close friend, but she posted on Facebook, and she's always posting about, you know, pray for this, you know, cause and et cetera. Very, very faith-based person.
Yeah.
Well, Taylor Swift made an endorsement this week.
She did.
Of Kamala Harris for president, and as a result, this person who's usually very up, positive posted this, you know, rant against Taylor Swift and, you know, I'm never going to listen to her music anymore, et cetera, et cetera.
At never, very, ever, ever?
Yeah. ever going to listen to the music all together. Right. So anyway, at the very end of the post, it said, I pray that she remains childless, a childless cat lady forever.
Ooh.
And I just was like, wow. I know you, lady who's posted this. You're a good person. Mm-hmm. Now, when did we ever start using the power of prayer for, you know, something
wishing
like
ill.
That?
Yeah.
Which made me think, huh, what's going on to spur up this type of anger?
Uh-huh.
Fast forward. Sitting in a restaurant earlier this week. Occasionally people will come up and say things to us, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw someone that I knew, also from, you know, a person I know to be of moral character, mm-hmm. et cetera.
A good person
who came up to me and said, what do you think is going to happen in the election? And then made some type of comment of, you know, what if the shooter wouldn't have missed or could the guy die of a heart attack or something?
Oof.
And it was referring to, you know, and I thought to myself that was the end of our conversation. The person moved on. And I was just like, wow, what's gotten into people where this is, number one, their reaction to politics, and then number two, because we all have bad thoughts at times, but then to verbalize them or to put them out to the whole world of this is, it took me back from two people I know to be good quality humans. It just took me back and thought, wow, what's going on?
Well, it's pretty dark, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, you know, I think for far too many people in the country place far too much significance on politics. And, you know, and it may seem odd coming from me because it's what I do for a living. I spend my waking hours doing politics. There are times I wish I didn't, but that's how, you know, you got to pay the bills. And, you know, I'm decent at the game. And so, you know, I enjoy the back and forth of politics. I enjoy the strategy of politics. I enjoy making decisions that affect the outcome of things. That, you know, those are all very rewarding things. But your priorities, if you place too high of a priority on politics, as I think too many people do, it does skew you, and it does change you, and it does cause you to do and say things that you otherwise wouldn't do. If, you know, I happen to believe that this is the greatest country in the history of the world, and I happen to be very grateful that I live in it. But I don't believe that all is going to ruin if the opposition wins.
Right.
You know, in the course of my career, the opposition wins about half the time. And somehow the sun comes up, and somehow we go to work, and somehow we pay our bills, and somehow we find time to enjoy snooker. And, you know, somehow it's going to be okay. And I think a lot of people don't believe it's going to be okay. And I think that's true whether you love Donald Trump or hate Donald Trump. And I think that's unfortunate. And I think that not having a proper perspective of your priorities can drive you to say and do things that you probably, in hindsight, would regret.
Right. And knowing these two individuals, and by the way, they're symptomatic of a larger audience out there. Knowing them, I know them both to be good humans. So I give them grace, if that's the right word. But at the same time, what's going on? What is doing this? Where did we cross this line? Is it, you know, I don't know if this is, you know, it's a simple excuse that gets used by everybody. But I know with this phone and when I look at it, the algorithm is feeding me stuff to get my blood pressure
up. Of course
up.
It does. Yeah.
And I feel like it's intensified. And John, there's no reason that some of the things that should show up in the algorithm to me show up other than to anger me. The computer's smart enough to know what side of the aisle I'm on. And I mean, is that what's going on? Are we, these are huge terms, but are we being brainwashed to a certain extent that we're being pushed to this edge of anger that could be violence? And if I, just one last point, you know, Dick Gephardt always said to me that politics is a substitution for violence. So it's an intense game, but I, like you said, I've lost more than I've won, and I don't really necessarily loathe and hate the people that I've lost to.
For the record, I have won more than I've lost.
Well, I think I'm about 50-50. The same that I think that most recently I beat you, didn't I?
You did.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
You did. So I'll tell you, this is just from my own past. When I was just coming on to vote, my first vote was for Ronald Reagan for president. And he won. And then my second presidential vote was for George Herbert Walker Bush for president. And he won. And I was at that time an office holder myself. And so politics was like important,
mm-hmm.
very important. And I was plotting my ascendancy to the White House at that time. And so what happens in 1992, along comes Bill Clinton, who I didn't much care for. And, you know, I didn't think much of him as a person or anything else, and he won. And I remember for 48 hours just being devastated that this is going to be terrible. There's no way we're going to make it through that. He might, you know, heaven forbid he serves 8 years. Think of the damage he right. can do. And he becomes president. I didn't like him. He did stuff that I didn't like. He gets reelected after, you know, it was before he was impeached. He was,
right.
But, and you know what? The country survived that pretty well. In fact, we came out of it with a balanced budget for the first time, the only time in my lifetime. And that I learned a real lesson there about the elections do matter. They do have consequences. Stuff's going to happen that you're not going to like. But it's a country whose institutions are resilient enough to withstand.
Well, everybody take a chill pill. I know we're all wearing our shirts. I had people pointing out to me they got Donald Trump ties and hats, and there's people running around with pink hats and et cetera. It's fine. But at the end of the day, we're all human. We got to get through this together.
Indeed,
and,
indeed.
I don't like to see good people going down bad roads.
Yeah. You know, one of the news stories in recent days that I don't believe has gotten the attention it merits is there was a breathtaking Israeli commando raid carried out on a secret weapons site in Syria against an Iranian missile production facility. They got in there. They got out of there. They blew the place up. They took some massive amount of intelligence materials from there. And they got a couple or three or four hostages, even scientists that were working in that facility. It's the first time that Iran itself has really kind of paid a real price. And I'm curious about how they did it, what they did, and what it means. And we're going to break that down with our own CBS News military analyst, Colonel Jeff McCausland, right after this on KMOX. So I almost missed this event that happened, I think it was a week ago. Well, it was last Sunday. But Israel and Israeli commandos carried out a raid on a secret weapons facility inside of Syria. Very complicated raid, a very successful one. They were able to destroy that facility, gain a tremendous amount of intelligence. Colonel Jeff McCausland, who knows about such things, is kind enough to join us this morning on our guest line. Colonel Jeff McCausland, retired U.S. Army colonel, who serves currently as a CBS News military analyst. Colonel McCausland, welcome back. And what is it that Israel pulled off on Sunday?
What they pulled off is a pretty spectacular special operations mission against this place in Masaf, which is called the Scientific Studies and Research Center for Syria, but it's also widely known to be a place that Hezbollah, the terrorist group operating out of southern Lebanon, has used for the production of missiles, guidance system, et cetera, which they've used in the weapons they've used against Israel. And it was a combination of several airstrikes followed by a special operation mission, because the central control facility in a bunker was so deep, the Israelis were convinced that the airstrikes would be insufficient. They managed to pull the mission off. Apparently, according to the Syrians, 18 Syrians were killed, 37 were injured. The Israelis apparently suffered no casualties and did, in fact, apparently destroy the command center and capture a wide-ranging amount of intelligence on what exactly Hezbollah and the Syrians were doing together at this facility.
So how do you go about, how does one go about planning for this sort of, because, I mean, this kind of seemingly, for us, came out of nowhere. There had to be a great deal of planning for this.
Oh, without a doubt. They've struck this particular site with aircraft a number of times. And, of course, every time you do an aircraft against a place like this, then you conduct post-battle assessments to try to calculate how effective have you been. And I think from that, the Israelis became convinced over time that, yeah, they were having some effect, but they certainly weren't destroying the facility. And that moved them towards this type of a spec ops mission. And then you plan these things. You may literally plan these things over months. I mean, consider the raid we did on Abbottabad with the killing of Osama bin Laden. That was not planned on the back of an envelope. That was planned for months. And in fact, that actually building was actually constructed for the teams that were going to conduct the mission to actually conduct practice landings, practice raids on, go through branches and sequels if certain things went wrong. And I'm certain the Israeli spec ops conducted the same type of rehearsals to make sure they had their timing down to the absolute second. Also, apparently, in addition to prepping the battlefield with some airstrikes prior to the spec ops guys going in, they also combined that with a number of drone overflights, because as some Syrian advancing reinforcements were moving to the area, as they were coming in, as the Israelis were coming in, they actually used those drones to hold those reinforcements off while the Israelis were completing the mission.
How difficult is it to get ground forces? Because ultimately, as you say, the airstrikes weren't sufficient to destroy the facility. How difficult is it to get ground forces into a foreign land? You know, in Syria, has their own issues going on right now.
Right.
That's got to be the most tricky part of the whole deal.
Yeah, to some degree, it's absolutely true. Now, you've got certain advantages. Of course, this particular facility is not that terribly distant from Israeli territory, so you don't have to overfly a large portion of Syria to do that. Second of all, of course, Syrian air defenses are probably pretty limited based on all the problems that are going on in Syria, and a lot of the Hezbollah air defense systems have been neutralized by the Israelis in advance. But you're going to go in with helicopters. You're going to go in very low level to try to stay in under the radar. You're probably going to go in at night to reduce visibility. You're going to make sure, of course, everybody's equipped with night vision goggles and whatever to operate at night. You're going to own the night, as spec ops guys like to say. And you're going to go in as fast as you can in that particular aircraft to spend as little time in the air as possible, get the mission over with, and then get out. But at the same token, you know, there's that great saying, you know, Murphy's Law, anything that can go wrong will go wrong normally at the last moment. And back to Abbottabad, recall, of course, that one of the helicopters had a problem and crashed, all of a sudden the whole plan then has to quickly change. And probably in many ways, I always thought the biggest hero of the Abbottabad race was the helicopter pilot when the helicopter had a problem that got it on the ground without a disastrous crash landing and allowed the mission to continue.
Colonel, just an incredible operation to hear how it all went down. Is there any worry now that as a result of this operation, there could be an escalation of the whole conflict? And are we seeing this whole, the borders of this war just grow exponentially in the entire Middle East region?
Well, it's certainly a fear of that. And clearly by striking Syrian territory, you are drawing the Syrians, you could say, into this, though the Israelis have conducted airstrikes against Syria throughout this war, most notably an airstrike a few months ago, which killed an Iranian Revolutionary Guard general and a couple other senior officers in Damascus. And in return, you had this massive strike by Iran against against Israel. So there was clear examples of escalation. I think, second of all, what it suggests to some degree is the Israelis are now shifting their focus. Israeli military have said, you know, to a large degree, Hamas is destroyed as a military force. Yes, there are pockets of Hamas fighters still in the Gaza Strip, and they may take some longer period of time to destroy all of them, but as a coordinated large force, Hamas has been destroyed. Now they can focus their attention more and more, and the Israelis are saying this, on the north. And don't forget about 60,000 Israeli citizens been forced from their homes in northern Israel since this war began because of the attacks by Hezbollah using artillery, missiles, rockets on those villages in northern Israel. And there's a high demand in Israel right now to get those people back in their homes. So I think we're going to see a refocus and a re-emphasis by the Israelis on northern Israel, on Hezbollah, and potentially even an incursion by Israeli ground forces into Lebanese territory, which, as you suggest, would be enormously escalatory.
So just have about a minute. I wanted to get your thoughts on Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Poland this week, talking and meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky and talking about supplying long-range missiles that could be used to fire into deeper into Russia. And Vladimir Putin has now said that that would equate to a NATO offensive war against Russia. How big of a concern are these developments?
Well, they're a big concern. And of course, Blinken not only went to Poland, he went on to Ukraine. And he was accompanied by David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain. And that was notable because the British are also interested in allowing the Ukrainians to use a longer range weapon they provided, similar to our ATACMs called Storm Shadow. And today, Keir Starmer, the new Prime Minister of Great Britain, will be meeting with President Biden to discuss this issue in the Oval Office. But Putin has made these kind of escalatory threats before, witness back when we gave the Ukrainians the HIMARS, or we gave the Ukrainians the F-16s, or we gave the Ukrainians the M1 tank. In every one of those particular efforts, the immediate response from Putin was, this is escalatory, NATO is now at war with Russia. So there's certainly a great deal of concern about this. But in past, we've seen Mr. Putin rattle his saber and draw these red lines, only to see him then back down in the aftermath.
That is Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst. Always enjoy his insight. Sorry we missed you when you were in town last week, but we'll catch up with down the road. The news is next on KMOX, and we've got a news potpourri coming your way next on KMOX.
All right, it's time for a rapid fire segment. Let's talk about Prince Harry. You remember him, right?
Hank the Tank.
Yeah, he's the spare.
He's the one that resigned his position.
He's living out in what, Montecito, California?
Yeah, he and Meghan Markle.
Montecito. He will be marking his 40th birthday.
Is that right?
With a private celebration with his wife, Meghan, and their two children.
Wow.
You remember when he was born, probably, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, little guy.
I remember watching.
Didn't have the beard back then.
Yeah, you know, the pictures of he and his mom, you know, and they were cute little kids.
They were cute.
Because they were going through the divorce when they were little ones.
Yep.
And then, of course, who will forget upon her death watching those two boys walk behind the casket? It's just kind of strange where things are today.
Yeah, no doubt. And wish a happy birthday to Hank. You know, he's had a had kind of a rough go. Of course, he doesn't like all the attention.
Right?
Yeah.
Anybody who televises their own therapy, that's what he was doing. He was having pay-per-view. Yeah. You could watch him with his therapist.
Wow.
That's a person saying, look at me.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Yeah. Well, it would be hard, you know? I mean, you're the little brother and your big brother, you know, he does well in school and he's on the football team and, you know, he's your big brother and he's going to be the king.
Yeah, your psychology's got to be a little messed up.
That would be kind of tough.
Doesn't sound like their dad was too engaged.
My older brother's done fine, but he's not going to be the king.
Everybody treats your grandma like a queen, and nobody seems to pay attention to anybody else.
That's right.
Oh, she was the queen.
She was the queen, Grandma.
I bet the psychology there is really, really, really messed up.
It would be hard.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, here you are, and you come along, and you're, you know, 2.5 years late. otherwise, he could have been the king, you know?
Laura Loomer. That's a lady's name I had never heard until 48 hours ago.
Uh-huh.
She came on the airplane with Donald Trump to Philadelphia. And
she went with him to 9/11.
Right. And they said she's the one that came up with the whole dog and cat eating thing. John, who is this woman? I never even heard of her.
She's a social media person, very big Trump supporter.
Uh-huh.
She's also what they call a 9/11 truther. She texted a year ago that was an inside job.
Ah.
And then there she shows up at the 9/11 memorial this week.
My word.
She's out there. She's so far out there, Michael, that she's drawn the ire of being inappropriate. She's drawn the ire of Marjorie Taylor Greene. Marjorie Taylor Greene held a news conference yesterday saying that this...
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding you.
Uh-huh.
Laura Loomer is too extreme. Too dangerous, and she's doing a disservice to the campaign. Seriously, though, I mean, that did happen, but seriously, to have that so close to the ear of Donald Trump, certainly,
right.
I think to believe, because I know Chris LaCivita, who's kind of ostensibly running that campaign.
Right.
I gotta believe that's driving the professionals in that organization crazy. But here we are.
Yeah, how could it not? But I mean, no surprise that this man would be listening to the last voice that he talked to, and he gets enamored easily with women in particular. So who knows? That will be interesting to watch. How about Taylor Swift comes out, endorses Kamala Harris, and then almost 500,000 people go register to vote. I always like these stories. This happened the last time she made an endorsement, and we didn't see any appreciable difference in young people's voting patterns. That's really the little secret here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very unusual to get a spike in youth voting now, and it did happen for Barack Obama the first time in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose it could happen here as well. The problem, though, you've got, if you're just looking at the youth vote, a lot of younger male young folks really are kind of into Donald Trump.
Well, it's not only younger males. I was looking at, you know, voters 50 to like 30.
Mm-hmm.
They're really strong with Trump. And it's interesting because some of the more conservative voters had been older voters, and we're seeing them lean more towards Kamala Harris. So crazy, crazy election. How about this? Do you remember, I guess it was around the millennium, we had those tsunamis that went all over the world?
Yes. And
horrible thing, right? Killed millions of people all over the world, etc.
It was really bad.
And the videos, and the videos they showed, those waves were, you know, 100 feet tall. I mean, it's unbelievable how big they're. They have now decided that earlier this week, was it this week or earlier this month? All right, here it is. Hold on a second. There was a 600-foot tsunami in Greenland.
Greenland.
In a fjord, an F-J-O-R-D, fjord.
I love fjords. It's got to be.
What is a fjord?
It's got to be the coolest word. First of all,
F-J-O-R-D.
When you follow an F with a J, you're doing something really cool and very special. Fjord. It's just fjord. I'd love to. Oh, you ask what a fjord is.
Yeah, what is a fjord?
Well, Michael, a fjord is...
It's like a body of water between two canyons.
Well, you got the water, and then you got the mountains on the both sides. So you got this beautiful. You go through the fjords in Norway.
Right.
A lot of people just go to Norway for the fjords. It's the fjord. They call it fjord sightseeing.
So,
and you're in the water. You got the mountains right there.
Right,
it could be better than water and mountains. It's a fjord.
So listen to what happened. Yes. So there was a because of thawing of the ice, there was also an erosion of land, and a huge chunk of land fell into the fjord in Greenland. To the point where it caused the earth to vibrate for 9 days. It caused a tsunami that was 650 feet tall. That's higher than the arch. So in this fjord, which I'm assuming is like a, almost like a canyon with the water inside of it, one side of it falls, pushes the water 650 feet into the air. How do they know this? It's in the middle of nowhere in Greenland.
Yeah.
No humans were there. There's a site that was there for sled dogs, and that had built been built a couple hundred feet above the water. And then there was some military helicopters who were going over and noticed that that site was wiped out, and then started to look at all the land around the fjord, and it was wiped up, and they found that the splash water went over 600 feet tall, a tsunami of 600. Just imagine being a duck sitting out on that pond, and all of a sudden you're 600 feet in the air because the water.
Good thing you can fly. Ducks fly.
do they?
Yeah, they do.
Not really well.
Well, they do.
Oh, what's the one that's really obnoxious that gets in the way of your car every time we go to Channel 2?
The goose. The goose. Yeah.
They fly, but they don't fly well.
Well, ducks fly well. You know, they're flying up there in
Yeah, the ducks get shot. People shoot those.
They do.
I wish people would go after them. What are those things called? The goose that walks in front of
the
us.
The goose?
Yeah, boy, it's an ugly animal.
Yeah,
and mean. And they're dirty.
I hate to share this.
What's that?
So I'm driving down this a few years ago.
Uh-oh.
I'm driving down the outer road, but I'm minding my own business. And I don't know. I'm probably fidgeting with the radio or some such
right.
thing. And I look up, and there's a goose.
Oh.
Yeah, right over the goose.
Yeah.
And I look in the rearview mirror, the lady behind me, she's shaking her head, you know, like and what do you do?
Well, you get out. If you're Bobby Kennedy, you get out, you throw it in the trunk, you take it home, you clean it up, put it in the freezer for roadkill.
What do you do? I mean, I felt terrible.
Ditto.
So I did what anybody else would do. I kept going to Snooks.
This summer, I had one of those situations where I was coming through some of the side roads to get downtown, through some of the beautiful neighborhoods of the West End. Lots of squirrels in the West End.
Oh, squirrels.
A squirrel ran out in front of me, and I tried to slow down. Yeah. I was only doing 25 miles an hour, but he got under the wheel. I felt it. And when I looked in the rearview mirror, I could still see that he was, alive, but there was squirting of liquid, and it just made me miserable.
This. Yeah, well, nobody wants
it
to
It made
hear that.
Me miserable. I don't know that I would have that same reaction to that goose that's mean to me.
I didn't paint the picture of what the goose looked like. I painted a picture of the lady behind me shaking her head.
Well, I mean, the goose was substantive. If you had a bump, it was like hitting a speed bump. The proper thing for you to have done was to get out and take that home and put it in the freezer and eat it later.
No, I'm not going to eat a goose.
Or throw it in Forest Park. That would have Bobby Kennedy would have done, right?
But, you know, the people that pick up these animals that meet their untimely demise, a salute to them, because that's not a job that anyone would relish.
And you know, sometimes you'll go down Highway 40 here in St. Louis, or as normal people would call it, 64?
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll see a dead deer in the middle of Highway 40 out there by Highway 270. And it's, who's got to clean that up? Well, the streets department.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's
and that's usually that nasty smell. You ever hit a deer?
No. That'll make you appreciate talking on the radio for
You've never hit a deer?
Never have hit a deer.
Have you ever seen a deer encounter driving?
Oh, yeah. But I've never, the only animal I've ever unfortunately run over was that goose.
And he was just sitting there, and weren't paying attention.
He was walking. I didn't notice him until it was too late.
Was he in a crosswalk?
He was walking across the street.
No.
Which, let that be a lesson to all you geese out there. traffic is serious, and it's dangerous. And you gotta look both ways with your little goose head before you start waddling across the street, because it could be the last waddle.
Yeah,
you ever do.
You may get a concussion.
We've got new kickoff rules in the NFL, Michael, and lots of things going on in the world of sport. And we're going to tackle those things when we come back next on Camel X.
I don't want to belabor the point, but there was a Christmas commercial during that segment. I don't know if you heard it.
It's coming, man.
I mean, can you believe it's already time to be advertising Christmas stuff?
I'm ready.
Okay, so we're about week two of my problems with DirecTV, not having access to ESPN.
I feel your pain, buddy.
Miserable, brother. It's miserable. I hate when billionaires fight with billionaires. But now that we've had a week of pro football, you've seen the kickoff.
Yep.
You can't move until, do you like it?
I do.
Do you think it's making the game, obviously it's making it safer. Do you think it's making it more entertaining?
Potentially. It's the strategy is that most teams appear to me anyway to be just kicking it into the end zone, which was the problem that existed last year and for several years where there was no action on a kickoff.
Right.
Ball gets kicked into the end zone. They take it back then. They get it on the 25. Now they get it on the 30. So that's supposed to be an incentive for teams to run the ball.
Uh-huh.
But what they've done is they've adopted the UFL rule. So the kicker's on the 35-yard line, same as before. But the players, as opposed to being cavernously apart, the offensive and the defensive lines that clash, running at full speed, they are now 5 yards apart, and they're on the receiving team's 40-yard line is where the defenders stand. And nobody can move until the ball hits the ground in the zone, and it's got to be from the goal line to the 20, or the receiver touches the ball. And at that point, then the collisions begin, and you go. And so the idea was, as they do in the UFL where the Battle Hawks play, was to get more action on the kickoff. Where it is utilized, I think it's an exciting play. I like it. But they're still preferring to just hand them the ball on the 30.
Yeah, and one of their big concerns was concussions and injuries that take place. And speaking of those, last night, Tua Tagovailoa, I don't know. Let's just call him Tua with Miami.
Uh-huh.
I think he's had a concussion in every season that he's been in the NFL.
Almost. He's had 4 or 5.
Yeah, and he suffered one again last night. I mean, you saw it the second it happened.
Yep.
Number one, if they continue to allow this man to go out there, does the concussion protocol mean anything?
Yeah.
And, boy, it's hard to watch those, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, there's plenty of medical study of this. This is a life-altering condition, potentially. And here you've got a young man, one of the top quarterbacks in the league, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he's had 4 or maybe 5 of these concussions now. He's got, I think, $163 million on his contract, 93 of which is guaranteed. You do wonder, at what point do you just say, I can't do that? I mean, I can't do this to my family. You're putting literally taking your life in your own hands.
Have you seen the helmets that these guys wear in practice now that they're like 3 times the size of a regular helmet, and they say it makes them safer?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to tackle from the helmet anyway. Not run. Why not have those on all the time?
Well, of course, concussions can be caused by contact with the ground you know, that was not a dirty hit last
night. No, it wasn't.
So,
but, I mean, it was just unfortunate knowing the guy, what's happened to him.
Hey, listen,
let's remind people. Sunday morning, 8:30, Fox 2, Hancock and Kelly, the television show. Amy's on vacation. No surprise. Chris Ranji's working. We'll talk to him after this on KMOX.